And on the line with us this afternoon is Dr. Ogechika Alozie. He is an infectious disease expert and the chief medical officer at Del Sol Medical Center here in El Paso. Dr. Alozie, welcome to El Paso Primetime.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
Listen, the last time we talked was pre-pandemic when we were just barely talking about this thing. And, you know, the notion was, well, you know what? If we do this, 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 and this, we should be able to be good. Well, here we are about to get into November. We're not good.
Yeah. It's unfortunate, really, that considering all the lives that have been lost, all the disruption to our economy, that we really don't have this in a place where we would have hoped we did. And, I mean, I'm sure years from now we'll have the postmortems. There'll be documentaries and series and scientific investigations as to what exactly caused us to fail as spectacularly as we have. But I think right now we need to figure out how do we get out of it.
Agreed. And I think one of the things to take away from this whole thing is to really step back to what this virus, it really is. I mean, it's a piece of DNA. It's surrounded by protein. It has a couple of genomes. And yet it seems to have a mind of its own. It becomes a virion at times, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I think one of the things, I feel sort of like that's hyperbole, right? I mean, it's a virus.
Right. And
at the end of the day, as human beings, we're going to have the ability to defend ourselves, protect ourselves, and vanquish this virus. But people have to remember that it's the first time we're seeing it. And so we've gone from identification of the virus and its genome to vaccine trials, the fastest we ever done in human history, from what should usually be a four-year process to an under one-year process. So I don't get bogged down in the whole COVID is the boogeyman conversation, right? Because we have the expertise, science, and knowledge to get through this. And we're seeing that with monoclonal antibodies coming out, the ability to potentially have a vaccine by next year, we'll get there. It'll just take some time. I think one of the other things that we need to really understand, right, when people say, well, in March you said masks didn't work, and now they do. In March you said that it would be gone by the summer, and now it's not. I think people need to also remember that what we have today, right, I haven't met any patient in the last 2 weeks that's told me, well, remdesivir and dexamethasone didn't exist in March and April, so I don't want them for myself and my loved one right now. This is called the evolution of science. This is medicine. This is what happens usually behind a curtain because the rest of the world isn't looking at it. It's normal for us in medicine. It just seems very strange and very convoluted to the public that's experiencing in real time right now.
As a virus, this is just one of, what, 4,800 different variants of SARS?
I mean, there's a host of variants. I can't remember off the top of my head. There's about 9 classes specifically.
Right.
But we can talk about the genetic variations another time.
Well, yeah, that's very true. I think some of the sometimes we in the business start getting a little bogged down about the variants of this particular thing. If we hear that it may be mutating, it may not be mutating, this, that, and the other. And you brought up a valid point. You know, with summer coming around, we thought this would be vanquished, but we didn't really pay attention to what was going on in Australia, where our springtime was their fall and then winter. And so what was happening there is now becoming replicated here.
Yeah. I think, again, one of the things for me has been there was a mythology around it would be gone by summer. There was never any common sense belief by real scientists or people who had studied virology and epidemics that it would be gone by summer. I mean, all the major scientific organizations across the world knew that this would be with us until we had a vaccine. It's unfortunate that we got politicized and distracted by the task at hand, right? We had one task, and that was to foil this virus. We failed it because we didn't do what we should have done from a public health standpoint. People keep telling me that, well, public health failed. They said, no, it didn't fail. What happens is that politicians fail.
Right.
Public health was really clear about what needed to be done. Physically distance, wear a mask, hand hygiene, watch your symptoms. We failed as a country in doing that. Now, in saying that, I think it's important to also note that Europe did a much better job than us up front. Look at Europe's numbers, right? They're beginning to ramp up in the same pattern. But again, from an epidemiologic and virologic standpoint, it was estimated that the winter would be tough because people slow down. They're in closer contact. They're indoors, especially in some of the colder states. And so whether it started in the Northeast, blossomed in the Sun Belt, or is taking a hold in the Midwest right now, at the end of the day, 45 out of 50 states, as we're speaking right now, are having increasing epidemics. And El Paso probably has one of the worst epidemics in America.
In thinking about that, I think about New Zealand and how they were able to actually contain the virus to a point where they had very few deaths, very few issues in the emergency rooms. Ventilators were at an all-time low. And at the end of the prime minister's first term, she got elected overwhelmingly into her second term because of the way she handled this pandemic. And you said it perfectly about politicizing a disease that should never have been politicized in the first place.
Yeah, we really sort of lost our way in terms of how we manage this. And again, zealots on either side can get bogged down by that. I think reasonable people in the middle would agree that some of the tenets of public health we decided were taboo. We made them very fractionated, and so that's where we are right now. I think it is not too late to get there. We need to have sort of a centralization or a coalescing of guidance around this thing. I think most people understand that if you don't trap this virus, if you don't limit its spread, what we see happening in El Paso is what potentially happens in your community again. And that's what the tragedy is. It's that human tragedy, right? We're social beings, and so I've never really liked the term social distancing. It's more about physical distancing. But the ultimate tragedy is when you have to physically distance from a loved one who's in a hospital and have to die alone. I think that's the ultimate tragedy.
Yeah, we're hearing more and more and more of those stories just about every day. And we stop and think about how this is impacting all of us, from an economic standpoint, from a personal standpoint, from an emotional standpoint. And yet there are people who are now beginning to speak of this thing as the COVID fatigue factor. I don't want to wear the mask anymore. I just want to go out and do stuff. I don't want to be a social distance. I just want to go have a beer. You know, that kind of a thing. And it just continues to spread.
Again, I think you're 100% correct when you talk about the COVID fatigue. And I think some of our greatest generation, right, that fought in World War II, they would look at us and sort of giggle, right, or laugh out loud and say, we had to do this for 4 or 5 years. What are you complaining about?
Mm-hmm.
The world we live in, we haven't in our generation had to face turmoil and tragedy like this is, and so we're struggling through it. I tell people at the same time, however, that if you look at the long length of human history, this is just a sliver in time. Is it uncomfortable? Absolutely. Do we have a way out of it? Also absolutely. But it's going to take work. It's going to take work that potentially as a populace we haven't been used to, which is coming together to follow a plan, coming together that to potentially limit some of our human freedoms and realities so that we can focus and get things done. I mean, you mentioned the economy. And I don't pretend to be an economist. And I didn't stay in a Holiday Inn Express last night. But I think what is also important is that if you look at, for example, the local El Paso economy, we were probably at our lowest positivity rate sometime in September, 4 to 6 weeks ago. Even at that, talking to local business owners, talking to people that are running the economic numbers for the city, we were still 20 to 30% depressed year over year from where we should have been.
Right.
So if that's the best that we could get to, and our positivity rate was around 4.5, it makes no sense that we allowed it to get to almost 20 right now, right? We're probably down 40 or 50% over the next month, depending on how this thing plays out. And so there is no economy with a rampaging virus. And that's what people need to understand. It's not about personal responsibility. We all have to do this because the economy can't get back in shape. People that have children can't send them off to school, and therefore they can't get to work. And so there's multiple domino and ripple effects from this that without control of the virus, the rest of our sort of existence, the way we want our normal to be in air quotes, doesn't really exist or make sense.
You're on the front line virtually every day on this thing.
Yeah, it's been intriguing to say the least.
I can imagine. So the question is, after listening to city officials talk about contact tracers being at a level of 270, which would be fine for the city, somehow for a city of 880,000 people, 270 seems like an awfully small number for contact tracers.
Yeah, so I can't remember whether it was the Brookings Institute, or may have been out of Mass General, but there were some estimates early on in the pandemic that you needed about 30 contact tracers per 100,000. So if you give us a million people, that would put us around 300,000. We're actually about 800,000. So the number the city had for that estimate is great. But I think people also need to realize that contact tracing is great when you have 50 cases a day, 100 cases a day, maybe even up to 200 cases a day. When you're at the levels that we have now of 500, 700, 800, 1,000 a day, we've had 2,000 cases in under 48 hours, it becomes physically impossible to contact trace. Because remember, every contact trace probably has 2 to 10 other people that you have to call, right? So that's 10,000 people that you're going to need to call. And the physical limitations of that system starts to break down. There are alternatives, obviously. I mean, some cities and counties, even countries, have used technology to sort of hack the numbers game and installing apps. But again, in our society and our personal freedoms, we don't want that invasion of privacy. So we sort of run up against some of the liberties of our country at the same time potentially hamper what we need to get done. And I'm not saying that any of our liberties should be taken away, but the liberties that need to be focused on is not spreading the virus. Because if we don't spread the virus, then the contact tracing team can do their job.
You know, I'm willing to give up a lot of my liberties if it means saving another person's life because of this COVID thing. Because it, to me, using an app that traces my back steps to the last place I was, to the last place I was and all that, and just maps my life until we're done with this pandemic, if that will save somebody else's life that's in my path, I'm all for it. I'm all in.
Yeah, it's interesting. A couple of things. I think when we sort of look at some of the dichotomies around the virus versus the economy, there was a movie called The Box back in 2009. And in that movie, there was this box that had a red button. And if you press the red button, they gave you $1 million, but one person died, right? I think it's interesting that we're making decisions around hundreds of thousands of people dying for our economy. But in terms of our sort of liberties, and you alluded to giving them up, as somebody that was in healthcare, information technology, as you know, it's remarkable to me that the same people that say this have a Google account or have a Microsoft account or do online banking or have an app that they shop with. All those apps are collecting and connecting their locations, what they do, how they spend, where they come in contact with on a daily basis. If they're on Facebook, Instagram, whatever it may be. And so I think, again, we've sort of gotten into this this spin zone of people spinning the truth to avoid the fact. At some point in time, we have to have some sort of reckoning around what's important to us, what are we going to prioritize, and how do we get out of this? And again, this is not to, quote-unquote, blame anybody. People have said that healthcare officials are blaming the society. Nobody's blaming anybody. But we all have to make decisions. But as a collective, those decisions should actually lead to an improvement of our society, not a degradation.
Yeah, I truly believe what you just said is something that wound up getting politicized, pointing a finger at somebody and blaming somebody for something that, quite frankly, none of us could have ever been blamed for a spread. You know, it just happens. There, with as many viruses that are out there, colds and flus, which brings me to another thing. With the flu season coming around the corner and mimicking somewhat what COVID puts into your system, how do we know the difference?
Yeah, it's kind of hard. We don't know the difference. And so if you think of what the term is, ILI, or influenza-like illness, it's cough, shortness of breath, fever, right? And that could be influenza. It could be SARS, coronavirus 2. It could be the common cold, which is also a coronavirus, by the way. And so any of those things can create that presentation of that ILI. I think what is lucky for us, and sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, that in the Southern Hemisphere that you talked about prior, they're down 90 to 90% across the board in influenza cases. Specifically, a lot of that is because they took up that behavior that we sort of eschewed early on, which is the masking and the physical distancing. And so New Zealand, for example, is down almost 99% from influenza. And since influenza is a Southern Hemisphere to Northern Hemisphere disease, usually with travel and a host of things, and travel is limited, there's actually that belief that we're not going to see as much influenza as we typically would. And we're not seeing it. I mean, I think we had 30 cases or something. By now, we should be well over 100. So, again, hopefully as we continue as a society to mask and physical distance and a host of other mitigation strategies, we can lessen influenza. I tell people all the time, get your flu shot, especially if you're somebody that has comorbid conditions or a host of other medical issues, definitely get your flu shot. But I'm hoping that that does not interfere or complicate the management of coronavirus going forward into the winter.
Agreed. If you've just tuned in, we're talking with Dr. Ogachika Alosi, who is the Chief Medical Officer at Del Sol Medical Center and is a highly regarded worldwide infectious disease expert. We're very lucky to have him on the line this afternoon to talk about COVID-19 and things that we need to really take care of. One of the things that will be coming around the corner very soon, Dr. Alosi, are the holidays. That starts in about a week and a half with Halloween, then Thanksgiving, then Christmas and Hanukkah, and on and on. I mean,
yep.
There's opportunity.
Yeah. There's a host of opportunities. You know, actually, it's a little bit concerning, and I understate that. One of the concerns we sort of look at this spread, and I'll focus on El Paso, is that as we're going up this sort of exponential curve, or whatever you'd like to call it, of thousands of cases a day. We know cases come before hospitalizations, then from hospitalizations, we go to deaths, unfortunately. The more we build up, we haven't reached our peak yet. And the concern is that if we compare this to our July-August period, we're probably a week to two, if we're lucky, away from our peak. But then what we saw was about a four-week plateau. Right. So let's say we stay at this level in our hospitals and we plateau for 4 weeks. Think about the emotional and physical stress and toil that puts on all healthcare workers and the city from an economic standpoint. And then a return to whatever new baseline is over a 4 to 6 week period. So just based on that, that's 2 weeks, 4 weeks, another 6 weeks. That's 12 weeks. That takes us into January. As you said, in that 12-week period, we have Halloween. We have Thanksgiving, we have Hanukkah, we have Christmas, we have New Year. We have a host of family-related and focused holidays that could continue to kind of trigger off another storm of cases. And so it's really going to take a lot. I mean, I think this is the hardest and darkest period that we will probably go through with coronavirus, especially in our El Paso community. And we're going to really need to buckle down and sort of get the message around how we're going to do this better.
So it brings me to another question. Are we not out of the first wave?
I guess it depends on what you want to define as a wave. I mean, if you look at the real sort of geometry of a wave, technically a wave returns to its baseline, doesn't it? If you go out and you surf a wave goes up and it comes back down to the baseline. I think the difference in the United States is that we're on wave three, right? We're on surge three. We had the Northeast, that was the initial group. And then we had the Sun Belt, right? That was Arizona, Texas, Florida that was driving that. And then we seeded the Midwest, and the Midwest is driving it. And it's interesting now that while initially it was the metropolitan areas that were driving it in wave one, they were kind of the same in wave two, right now it's actually urban areas that are driving spread, right? And so we have gone from a localized epidemic in the Northeast to a sort of minorly spread epidemic. And now it's across the whole country. 45 out of 50 states, as of the time of this conversation, are all going up. And so this is no longer just one surge. We really have global spread of this across the United States, unfortunately.
There will be listeners who want to know one way or the other, because they're going to travel, whether we tell them to or not, they're going to go visit their loved ones. So what's the safer travel? By car or by air?
Well, I think by car is always going to be the safest, especially if you're going with your family that you're already in contact with, right? So I think that's one thing to think about with that. Again, you're 100% right. Whether we tell somebody to travel or not is irrelevant. They're going to travel when they want to. I think people just need to be careful, whatever the case is. And I think one of the concerns, one of the disappointing things, as you've really seen what's happened over the last few months, is the spread amongst younger people who are absolutely less susceptible to tragedies and morbidity and mortality, but then that spread into older people, right? Multi-generational homes, going to visit their parents and their grandparents or uncles and aunts. And I think that's the real sort of frustrating and concerning thing.
As we look at what's going to be happening over the next 12 weeks, and it's a good conversation to really get into, because now as college semesters begin to wind down, whether they're already home because their universities are 100% online, or like, for instance, our university, which is partially online and partially in class, which means that some students are living here, when they go home, should they be tested and put into a 14-day quarantine before they go home?
You know, I think in an ideal situation, if we had ubiquitous testing, that would be the way to go about it, whether it was PCR testing or antigen testing. People that have been in a communal or congregate setting returning home to at-risk family members, I think it is the right thing to do to potentially test and self-isolate, you know. But we have come up against this backstop of just not having enough tests. We have a backstop that doesn't allow us to escape this because there's not enough testing. We have pandemic and epidemic spread amongst our community and multiple other communities. And so people are just going to have to be as careful as possible around masking and limiting their contact with loved ones, especially those loved ones that are older or have comorbid conditions.
I have pre-existing conditions going into this pandemic as a diabetic, overweight, high blood pressure, you name it. It's all part of my DNA, and I'm also over 65. So, you know, you talk about rolling the dice.
You need to stay away from everybody.
That's what I've been telling people on the air is, you know what, wash your hands, wear a face mask, self-distance, and stay the hell away from me.
I love it.
You know, because I don't want that disease. No one does, but why the younger generation seem to think that they're impenetrable, that it'll never happen to them. They work out, they do this, they do that. And yet we're seeing an uptick, and I hate that word uptick, to be honest with you. We're seeing that in the emergency rooms, younger and younger people are coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think the sort of what you mention in terms of young people, I mean, it's been there for generations. Young people do think they're invincible. I mean, I'm definitely not young anymore, but once upon a time, I thought I was invincible. And I saw this a lot, or I still see this a lot, in the HIV space, where I still do some work, where the younger MSMs or people that come in, they just feel as if HIV can't affect them anymore because the medications are great. And so we've seen this with a host of conditions over generations. It's unfortunate, however, that this virus specifically may not tarnish and affect the young, but they can continue to be vectors and give people that are at risk. And I think that's really the disappointing thing, in that many communities, we haven't been able to protect our vulnerable population. I think that's really where we needed to have gotten to. I think in some places they've gotten to it. It's a bit late, but hopefully we can continue to protect our elderly and our vulnerable as we go into the fall, because it's going to be really challenging.
Are we at a level right now where antibodies that are being created by people who have maybe turned the corner with COVID, are we at a point now where those antibodies will help someone else?
So I think you're talking about the convalescent serum or convalescent plasma. There was a lot of hype and noise about that. The data doesn't really seem to bear out that that's a therapeutic home run. I think we're going to have to be, and I'm stealing this from a host of other people that abuse this term, we're going to have to be content to singles and doubles, right? We're going to have to be content to therapies that take the edge off of mortality but don't knock it completely out. I think where we do have some hope is something that President Trump got, right, which is the monoclonal antibody or the polyclonal antibody cocktails. Those seem to really have some effect, and we need to see some of the peer-reviewed randomized controlled trial data around it to really understand. But between Eli Lilly and Regeneron, they're going to be coming out. Hopefully, those will get emergency authorization later in the fall. And then it's going to be a question of who actually gets it, because unfortunately, we didn't ramp up our production capacity earlier in the year, in the spring and summer, when we really needed to get the amounts that are going to be needed going into the fall. I think those actually provide us the largest bang for the buck or benefit until we get to a point where an actual vaccine that's going to be effective is actually available for general distribution sometime in the summer of 2021.
One last question. When do you see a viable vaccine?
Yeah, I think vaccines are something that are probably going to be how we get out of this eventually. As you know, there are five or six candidates that are presently going through phase three or some late stage two trials. We'll probably get some of that data end of November, early December, and then we'll have at least one or two candidates. I think irrespective of which company comes out first, what people need to realize is that we're then going to have a national rush for who gets these vaccines first. I mean, ideally, it'll be people that are vulnerable, comorbid conditions, people with high risk in healthcare. But even then, before we get to general availability of these vaccines, we're really talking a summer of 2021 event and potentially into the fall. So when we tell people that this is not going away in the summer, it's not going away in 2020, it's specifically because the vaccines that potentially give us a bridge out of this mess that we're in aren't going to be generally available until middle to late next year. And then we have to contend with how contentious does it get, right? Are we still at the point where 50 to 60% of Americans say they're not going to take the vaccine? That's concerning. And so we're going to have to navigate that. And so I appreciate what the FDA has done specifically now, because they've slowed it down. They haven't made it a political issue by releasing potentially flawed data before the elections. We can allow the elections to happen. That's a political event. And let science and discourse sort of take its time.
I'd like to catch up with you in about 4 weeks or so in order to see where we're going to be inside the holiday season. Dr. Okazika Alozie has been our guest on El Paso Primetime. Dr. Alozie, bless your heart. Love you to death. Mikasa Tsukasa. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it, my friend. Thank you. You be safe out there. Let's talk around Thanksgiving again.
That sounds good.
All right. Stay blessed.